Let's begin our Q&A, and again, I've been handed some questions, and I'll work our way through some of these. If there's more than one question per person, I might save those for later, or if I don't get your question and we have time for Q&A, we'll take those as well. Again, a kind of a random order, perhaps. I've tried to organize them a little bit, but since we just have a half an hour, I'll read the questions or state the questions, and we'll ask for a terse answer, if possible.
Okay. so we get through as many as we can. I could go on and on and only get one.
Sure, there we go. Perhaps for those who aren't familiar with some of the views that see Genesis 1 in a literary way, maybe you could explain, for example, a view like Salehammer or Walton and what they're doing with Genesis 1.
Okay, there's a number of different views other than what we may be used to as conservative evangelicals. One of them is the framework hypothesis that I mentioned, and by the way, if you want to read a good response to that, just check with Robert McCabe at Detroit Baptist Theological Seminary, who has written extensively in detail on it in Coming to Grips with Genesis and also in the Detroit Baptist Theological Journal. But basically, it's based upon a literary framework hypothesis of saying there's poetry, number one, and then those 6 days are paralleled to each other so that they are not chronological, and that the focus and evidence is upon the providence of God. Those are the three major arguments of the framework hypothesis. John Salehammer has modified that a little bit himself, although he adopts many of the same arguments. John Walton changes it slightly, adding in the concept of functionality, that everything that is created has a function, and it's the function we ought to be looking at, not the chronology of it, etc. And you can read his book on Genesis 1 that would explain that in full detail. Other views in the literary aspect of it, for example, treat it as purely the same kind of literature to be interpreted the same way as other ancient Near Eastern creation myths. And so those are just a few.
So, for example, with Salehammer, you have someone who suggests that Genesis 1 is really not about the creation of things, but it's about the preparation of the land for Israel's occupation.
Right. Both he and John Walton do that, saying that the story is really about Israel, not about the world as a whole, and therefore that Adam is perhaps just a man chosen out of many, one ethnic group being chosen, selected, and a temple analogy being developed around them.
Okay. What do you do with the question of the apparent signs of age? For example, the speed of light, how long it takes light to reach the earth, craters on the moon. Isn't apparent the idea of apparent age perhaps deceptive in our understanding of God's work?
Okay. If it is deceptive, then we're accusing God of deception. I don't see any deception of God in that. This is not a new concept. Someone tried to tell me the other day that this didn't begin until the 16th century with some group in England or Germany, and I said, no. Ephraim the Syrian back in the 4th century AD already said this in his commentary on Genesis, that it is obvious that God created everything fully functioning, therefore it had to have the appearance of age. If God could tell Adam and Eve at the moment they were created, be fruitful and multiply, they had to be mature enough to do so. And so, what about life? I mean, if you have plants, they've got to be mature enough to produce fruit for the life to be able to eat. And it appears in a straight statement of Scripture that that's the way God did. He created it mature. Let's look at that another way. Let's approach the answer this way. Do we have any other example of creation in Scripture that has the appearance of age outside of Genesis 1? Yes, we do. In the wedding feast at Cana, we have Jesus creating fully matured wine instantaneously out of nothing but water. And it is so good that the master of the feast complains that they left the best till last. And so we'd have to say there that that's a perfect example that Jesus Christ is perfectly capable of creating wine out of water with the appearance of age. Was he deceptive then in that? Was he deceiving? No, he was merely demonstrating what he's capable of doing.
I'm going to tie a couple questions together. This questioner asked, can you discuss the fossil evidence for the old Earth and why it is felt to be so compelling? And what is the answer for varying hominids, skeletons, humans, animal? What am I supposed to think of Lucy and Neanderthal man?
Okay. Number one, I'm not an anthropologist. I'm not a person who is a scientist dealing with paleontology. So I'm not able to answer these in a technical fashion or scientific fashion. I'll leave that to men like Thane Urey, Kurt Wise, who are, Kurt Wise is a trained paleontologist, and he can answer these questions more fully. But basically it's this, that the argument for the old Earth from the fossil record is that we have a vertical fossil record that seems to be organized and seems to be chronological. And whether you take that as a uniformitarian concept of gradual deposition or whether you take it as immediate deposition, there is sorting there that takes place. And because of all of that, you look at it and say there must be millions of years involved here, especially if you start watching how a river or a lake gains the bottom of it, how it begins to build up gradually with the verves of different layers of sand or silt. And they've got a lake in Japan they're measuring as it does that, and they're watching it seasonally and counting the amount of time necessary for each layer, and you start doing that type of thing, and it's going to take millions of years. But then the problem with that is you take something like Mount St. Helens and its eruption, and you see there the same layered effect in organized strata of rock that was laid down in the space of 36 hours, hundreds of feet of it in 36 hours. And then the flow of mud and debris and water then washed a canyon in it, very similar to the Grand Canyon in the various forms, in just a matter of hours. The evidence says you don't need millions of years to produce those layers. And also, the work they've been doing at Colorado State University in sedimentation in the flumes at Colorado State University demonstrate that there is a sorting process, and you can actually measure whether sediment is deposited by wind or by water, at what rate, at what speed, and how quickly, and what takes place with regard to sorting. And all of it really supports the model of a biblical flood that is the basis or foundation of almost all of such layers on the planet. The same layers you see in the Grand Canyon, the same layers you see in Israel, are the same layers you see in Australia, are the same layers you see in Russia. There's no difference. And interestingly, they all have the same direction of water flow, from northeast to southwest, no matter where you go on the globe. And the sorting is in accordance with how capable of mobility is the creature. The most mobile are the last to be buried in the uppermost layers. The less mobile are the first to be buried in the bottom layers. And then the bodies are sorted by weight and density, and just like they've been able to prove. And to me, then the scientific evidence that is given there, not just by creation scientists, but by secular scientists on work in sedimentation and fossilization, show that the flood is an adequate explanation of the geological column.
Do you want to deal with Lucy and Neanderthal man, or do you want to leave them to someone else?
No, there again, I think basically it boils down to the fact that, what is that? I mean, is it really truly human, or is it ape? And that perhaps has never been fully answered or responded to. And I would say it this way. Richard Leakey, the son of Louis Leakey, who was the finder of Lucy, wrote a book called Origins. In that book, he says specifically, in reference to his father as a leading evolutionist and to himself, that the acceptance of the theory of evolution is a matter of faith. He said it, not me. Get the book and look it up. And so it's the difference between two faith systems. It's the difference between two worldviews.
You perhaps already answered this question by stating your inability to answer it. But with regard to the death of plant life and so forth, or the other question that arises commonly in conjunction with that, is marine life and the larger marine animals living off of the smaller marine animals. Mm-hmm. You know, how do we deal with that before death?
I don't know what the answer is. As I said, I'm still researching that, looking at it. I had hoped, on the basis of an article I read, I'm the biblical editor for the Creation Research Society and their quarterly. And so I read the articles for biblical accuracy that they send me. And one of them was about that very issue. And it sounded so great. I thought, man, here's the answer I've been looking for. It's nefesh hayah, it's the soul of life. If it doesn't have that, then it can die and they're not counted as death. And also looked at Henry Morris and his view that life is in the blood of man, and therefore it's only man it's talking about. There's no such thing as life in the blood of an animal. Well, first of all, that seems irrational and inconsistent. I couldn't accept that. And I honored Dr. Morris. I thought he was a great man and still do. And I think he really helped to think things through in many ways, but I couldn't find that either. I couldn't settle with that. And I would love to continue that research and see what there would be. There appears to be some level of distinction that God might have made in that. And where that is or how it is or whether even it's discoverable in Scripture is something I'm still looking for. And so I just have to say I don't know.
So you don't have all the answers.
I don't have all the answers. No way. I have a lot of questions.
Thank you. This is an interesting question. It is grounded in Isaiah 25, 6 through 8. Assuming animal death is what is meant by death, quote, why does God serve a meal of wine and fire-roasted meat, dead animals, when he celebrates the swallowing up of death forever, Isaiah 25, 6 through 8?
Okay. First of all, that's the way God ordained the thing to be observed. Who am I to argue with why God chooses to do it that way? I think it has to do with the fact that we are living beings, having a relationship to a living God, and we live in a fallen world that is characterized and dominated by death. And the death of Christ is the most important of those. Why did he have so many sacrifices in the Old Testament that killed innocent animals? I mean, really, isn't that shocking? If it's not shocking to you, I wonder about your sanity. You know, you got to admit, as a Christian, that is shocking to see millions of animals slaughtered in sacrifice in the Old Testament when the New Testament says there's only one sacrifice that could take away sin anyway. Well, the answer struck me one day as I was teaching in South Africa. You know, the reason God allows that is to teach us about the horrible nature of my sin. I am the one, as a human being, who caused the death of those animals. If I think that's horrible, I need to look at my sin. My sin is that horrible, if not worse. And so I think part of it is that God just wants us to understand that the death we see around us is the result of our sin, is the result of Adam's sin, and because we are Adamic, our sin repeats his sin and his rebellion, and therefore our death is our own death because we are guilty. Our wages of sin is death. And so that horrible nature of death around us is part of helping us understand that we are so undeserving of God's grace. And I think that's part of even in the communion and in sacrifices and everything else, that death is intended to teach us about the horrible nature of our sin.
This is a theological question that ties in very closely. If I follow correctly, if one... oops, not the one I'm looking for. Sorry. Here we go. Adam died, and the entire human race died because they are sinners. Jesus, born without sin, never sinning in his lifetime, died. How was he able to die as a sinless human being?
Okay. Notice that Jesus gave up his soul. He voluntarily poured out his life as a sacrifice. Even the perfect man, if you drain his veins of blood, and if you put him in a position of crucifixion that suffocates him to where he cannot breathe, even a perfect man is going to die physically. All right? He voluntarily submitted to that in order to pay the penalty and be that sacrifice. He was not able to, and remember, he died in his humanity, not his deity. God did not die for us. The human nature that he took to himself was what died. His human nature died. His human body died. It was in his humanity he died, not his deity.
Again, a somewhat more theological question that ties in. With regard to the headship of Adam, the federal view and the seminal view, do you see one or the other, or do you see them necessarily as exclusive?
I don't see them as exclusive, and I don't see one being more true than the other. I think both are true. I believe you have to hold to both. That you have to believe in federal headship because Adam is the legal head of the human race, and that's how the forensic results of sin can be passed on. One of the ways. But you also have to see him as the seminal head, the physical head of the human race, because the imputation in the way that it is described, for example, in Hebrews chapter 7, is that it's passed on through the loins. And therefore, it is a seed and seminal relationship. And that's why the emphasis, I believe, also on the seed of the woman in comparison to the seed of man. So I believe that Scripture teaches both. Adam is both the physical seminal head of the human race, and he is the spiritual and legal representative of the human race, both seminal and federal headship.
A question about the trees in the garden. Do you see the trees as basically representative, symbolic, or do you see some kind of mystical quality in them right. That brought life or death, right. And especially as that ties into Revelation 22?
All right. Excellent, because as we look at that, what happened to those trees? And why is it that one fruit would produce one thing? Well, first of all, we have to remember the sin that was committed by Adam and Eve, and the results of that sin are not the result of the juice of the fruit, the flesh of the fruit, the skin of the fruit, or the sap from the tree. All right? It's not some medical infusion of some element or some liquid that creates the results. It is a spiritual disobedience. It is a spiritual consequence. So in some sense, actually, those trees are symbolic. They are real trees and real fruit, but as a test of obedience. And the real question is the obedience and disobedience, not whether it was done by eating the tree or whether it was done by some other means. So the tree is merely the tool God uses to help us understand something. I don't know about you. I'm a visual learner. And God thankfully provided a visual for that. And I think it was a reality. It's not something that's metaphorical or mythical. I think the trees actually exist. They actually took the fruit. They actually ate the fruit. But it had nothing to do with the consequences. It's the disobedience that had to do with it all. So it's an act of God. He demanded this. He gave the instruction. The disobedience is he gives the punishment. In the future, you find out that we're going to have a tree of life, we're going to have a tree that bears fruit, that is for the healing of nations. I think that's probably physical healing, which is interesting if you start talking about that. Is that only during the kingdom, or is that throughout eternity? Why is healing necessary? Those are some more questions I have that still need to be researched and found out. But I think it just demonstrates that, again, God can use the trees however he wants. He's the one who creates them, and if he wants to use them as a test, that's up to him. The consequences are not from the physicality of the fruit. The consequences are what he has imposed unilaterally and supernaturally because of the disobedience.
Okay, we have about 9 minutes. I have a few other questions that I could bring up. We have questions here, so we'll take some from the audience.
Those types of things, could that be part of the answer or not?
It could be part of the answer. I mean, you could ask the same question. If I cut off my thumb and eat it, is that death? Well, it's the cessation of living cells in a living organism, and in a sense, there's cell death that takes place there. Cell death takes place with gangrene. So in a sense, there's death, but it's not the death that we're talking about, right? Where you have the soul and spirit separated from the body, unless we believe that every cell has a separate soul and spirit. Right, which is complicated. So yes, that's possibly one of the answers and responses to it. Related to that, you didn't ask the question. I thought you were. But remember God said, we're going to cast out the man. We're going to remove him from the tree of life, lest he reach out his hand and eat and live on, right? Live forever. What was the tree of life there for? Did they eat it before? I think they did eat it before. I think that was God's plan. I think it was his design. And now he's saying it's not going to continue. And that's because, and this again, please take it, this is hypothetical, it's still something I'm working on, but I believe that really it may be that God originally designed man to live on planet Earth for 1,000 years. That would account for the decrease in life expectancies that start about 969 years and begin to decrease. It also accounts for the length of the kingdom. It also accounts for the fact that in Isaiah 65, a person lives 100 years as an infant. A person lives 1,000 years is evidently okay. I think God may have designed man to live for 1,000 years and then to be like Enoch, translated, transferred into the presence of God in heaven. Without the type of death we're looking at, it's just a transition of state, a transition of location. That could very well be what his original design was, and one of the means of that was he chose to use the plant of the tree of life as a means of preserving that life in that way. I don't know, but it's something to think about.
Another.
Abel. Luke chapter 11, verses 50 to 52.
Okay. Other questions or comments, suggestions? We have another one in the front and then one in the back.
Right. First of all, on the first one there, it's not just old earth people that look at that problem of whether the sun existed till day four or day one. Many young earth people also see that as a problem and have different explanations of what happened. If God is the light and can be life-giving, then it's his light that can suffice for the first 3 days rather than the sun. That's what happens in the end in Revelation 21 and 22. No more sun, no more moon, no more stars. It's not needed. God is the light. And also the fact that the problem comes when you talk about the speed of light. And the speed of light, how does a far, far distant galaxy, thousands and millions of light years away, get its light to Earth instantaneously? Again, it has to go either to the appearance of age or it has to be a variation in the speed of light. Interestingly, in 1989, when there was a total solar eclipse in India, the scientists discovered that one of the former astrophysicists had the right idea when he said that the speed of light might not be exactly what we think it is. It could be varied and that it could be bent. And in that particular time, in studying the light transfer and observing what they could see when the sun was obscured and allowed them to see, they discovered that the light can be bent and that the speed of light is not constant. And so it could be that the speed of light was different in the past and at creation than what it is now, not meaning an appearance of age necessarily, but just a different phenomenon, the way it occurred. An excellent book on this to read is the one by Guillermo Martinez, Something Planet. Anyone remember what that is? In intelligent design? Not Living Planet. Privileged Planet, thank you. The Privileged Planet. I would recommend you reading that, because I think that they have some excellent answers to that there and demonstrate that we're too reliant upon constants that can have variables. And what we do is we assume that what we see today, that's uniformitarianism, we assume what we see today is the same process at all times in ages past, and it might not be so. We have to leave that open. There was one more back there.
David.
Mm-hmm. Right. We have had it occur, and I don't know how often we would have it occur. I'm in the Evangelical Theological Society, and I'm one of the co-vice chairmen of a group on creationism, in which we have two chairmen, one that's old earth, one that's young earth. We have two vice chairmen, one that's old earth, one that's young earth, and we divide the papers that way every year. And we have a full discussion, open discussion, erenic discussion, and debate of the issues, and have a panel. And we are open to that discussion, not closed. And I think the only time I object is when you have someone who is so emphatic about his viewpoint that he begins calling someone stupid or ignorant. I mean, I'm ignorant enough as it is. So I don't need to be told I'm ignorant of something. But it all depends on their attitude and their way of approach. I'm not opposed to having someone stand in a pulpit in my church and tell us what his view is and how he came to the viewpoint that he did of an old earth. But that can be done erenically and respectfully, I think that's perfectly all right. I think that's a good discussion to have. How else do we expect our people to reach their conclusions and come to a solid conviction if we don't allow them to hear both sides and to discuss and wrestle with both sides of the issue? The best way to do that is to let them wrestle through it. And so the challenge is, who's the best to bring in for this, and who's the best to bring in for this, that can interact and work together in a peaceful fashion and respectful fashion. There'll be a model of Christian discourse, as well as helping my people to know what are the strengths and weaknesses of both views. So I would recommend that, if you can find the right two people to do that. I think it's a good thing to do. This man felt that it could be done, and I think that it is. It's a good idea.
In 10 seconds, could you give us perhaps the name of an organization or two, maybe a video series that could be used in a church, and maybe a website that would be a good resource for young earth creationism?
For young earth creationism, some of the best material is from Institute of Creation Research, from a scientific viewpoint especially, but even from the biblical. Answers in Genesis is another place to go. With good material. I will warn you that in Answers in Genesis, from time to time, Dr. Hamm is pretty fervent about his views, and he might say some things that step on toes and create some hard feelings. If you meet him personally and talk with him one-on-one, you'll find he doesn't always come across that way. But it does happen, because he's more evangelistic in his fervor, I'll put it that way. I work with both groups, and then the Christian Research Society as well. One of the things I really appreciate is some of the video that's been put out more recently, like on the Privileged Planet, that is available. It's more from the idea of intelligent design. And you have to remember that the majority of those who hold to intelligent design really also hold to an old earth. Philip Johnson, for example, who was mentioned to me the other day, Hughes, right? Or Hugh Ross. Hugh Ross is one. Men like that. Guillermo Martinez that I mentioned with the Privileged Planet. holds to millions of years. But what I find very interesting and helpful there is the attack on evolution, the rejection of the theory of evolution. Because to me, the theory of evolution, if that's what dominates and causes to take our position, that is far more dangerous overall, in its philosophy, its approach, its results, and consequences, than intelligent design. And both are old earth, but I would prefer to be the old earth type of intelligent design. And they have some amazing materials and things. Now, at times, just as in some young earth presentations, there's an exaggeration of some of the scientific evidence in a way that could be modified and changed and altered and be more consistent and objective. But that's going to exist no matter what view is held. I've seen the same inconsistencies with old earth, with evolution, etc. Everyone has the same problem. Why? Because it's origin science and we don't have any eyewitnesses and we're dealing with circumstantial evidence. And so there's going to be disagreements. It's how do we disagree? Friendly or unfriendly? Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Barrick. It's been good to have you with us. He'll be available for more questions individually. Otherwise, we're done.